Chapter 6. No furies came for me that night. None came the next morning either, or all that afternoon. By dusk, I went to find my mother at her mirror. Where is father?
Gone straight to Oceanus, the feast is there.
She wrinkled her nose. Her pink tongue stuck between her teeth.
Your feet are filthy. Can you not at least wash them?
I did not wash them.
I did not want to wait another moment. What if Scylla was at the banquet, lounging in Glaucus's lap? What if they were married already? What if the sap had not worked?
It is strange now to remember how I worried that. The halls were even more crowded than usual, stinking of the same rose oil every nymph insisted was her special charm. I could not see my father, but my Aunt Selene was there. She stood at the center of a clot of upturned faces, a mother and her baby birds, waiting to be crammed. You must understand, I only went to look because the water was so roiled up. I thought perhaps it was some sort of meeting. You know how Scylla is. I felt the breath stop in my chest. My cousins were snickering and cutting their eyes at each other. Whatever comes, I thought, do not show a thing. But she was flailing very strangely, like some sort of drowning cat. Then, I cannot say it. She pressed her silvery hand to her mouth. It was a lovely gesture. Everything about my aunt was lovely. Her husband was a beautiful shepherd enchanted with ageless sleep, dreaming of her for eternity. A leg, she said, a hideous leg, like a squid's, boneless, covered in slime. It burst from her belly, and another burst beside it, and more, until there were 12, all dangling from her. My fingertips stung faintly where the sap had leaked. That was only the beginning, Selene said. She was bucking, her shoulders writhing. Her skin turned grey and her neck began to stretch. From it tore 5 new heads, each filled with gaping teeth. My cousins gasped, but the sound was distant, like far-off waves. It felt impossible to picture the horror Selene described. To make myself believe I did that. And all the while she was baying and howling, barking like some wild pack of dogs. It was a relief when she finally dove beneath the waves. As I had squeezed those flowers into Scylla's cove, I had not wondered how my cousins would take it, those who were Scylla's sisters and aunts and brothers and lovers. If I had thought of it, I would have said that Scylla was their darling, and that when the Furies came for me, they would have shouted the loudest of all to see my blood. But now when I looked around me, all I saw were faces bright as whetted blades. They clung to each other, crowing, I wish I'd seen it. Can you imagine? Tell it again, an uncle shouted, and my cousins cried out their agreement. My aunt smiled. Her curving lips made a crescent like herself in the sky. She told it again, the legs, the necks, the teeth. My cousins' voices swarmed up to the ceiling. You know she's lain with half the halls. I'm glad I never let her have me. And one of the river gods' voices rising over all. Of course she barks. She always was a bitch. Shrieking laughter clawed at my ears. I saw a river god who had sworn he would fight Glaucus over her, crying with mirth. Scylla's sister pretended to howl like a dog. Even my grandparents had come to listen, smiling at the crowd's edge. Oceanus said something in Tethys's ear. I could not hear it, but I had watched him for half an eternity. I knew the movements of his lips. Good riddance. Beside me, an uncle was shouting, Tell it again! This time my aunt only rolled her pearly eyes. He smelt like squids. And anyway, it was past time for the feast. The gods wafted to their couches. The cups were poured, the ambrosia passed. Their lips grew red with wine, their faces shone like jewels. Their laughter crackled around me. I knew that electric pleasure, I thought. I had seen it before, in another dark hall. The doors opened and Glaucus stepped through, his trident in his hand. His hair was greener than ever, fanned out like a lion's mane. I saw the joy leap in my cousin's eyes, heard their hiss of excitement.
Here was more sport. They would tell him of his love's transformation, crack his face like an egg, and laugh at what ran out. But before they could say anything, my father was there, striding over to pull him aside. My cousins sank back on sour elbows. Spoil sport, Helios, ruining their fun. No matter. Perse would get it out of him later, or Selene. They lifted their goblets and went back to their pleasures.
I followed after Glaucus. I do not know how I dared, except that all my mind was filled up with a grey wash like churning waves. I stood outside the room where my father had drawn them. I heard Glaucus's low voice. Can she not be changed back? Every godborn knows that answer from their swaddles.
No, my father said. No god may undo what is done by the fates or another god. Yet these halls have 1,000 beauties, each ripe as the next. Look to them instead.
I waited. I still hoped Glaucus would think of me. I would have married him in a moment. But I found myself hoping for another thing, too, which I would not have believed the day before. That he would weep all the salt in his veins for Scylla's return, holding fast to her as his one true love.
I understand, Glaucus said. It is a shame, but as you say, there are others.
A soft metal ping rang out. He was flicking the tines of his trident.
Nereus's youngest is fair, he said. What is her name? Thetis?
My father clicked his tongue.
Too salted for my taste.
Well, Glaucus said, thank you for your excellent counsel. I will look to it. They walked right by me. My father took his golden place beside my grandfather. Glaucus made his way to the purple couches. He looked up at something a river god said and laughed. It is the last memory I have of his face, his teeth bright as pearls in the torchlight, his skin stained blue. In years to come, he would take my father's advice indeed. He lay with 1,000 nymphs, siring children with green hair and tails, well-loved by fishermen, for often they filled their nets. I would see them sometimes, sporting like dolphins in the deepest crests. They never came into shore. The black river slid along its banks. The pale flowers nodded on their stems. I was blind to all of it. One by one, my hopes were dropping away. I would share no eternity with Glaucus. We would have no marriage. We would never lie in those woods. His love for me was drowned and gone. Nymphs and gods flowed past, their gossip drifting in the fragrant torchlit air. Their faces were the same as always, vivid and glowing, but they seemed suddenly alien. Their strings of jewels clacked loud as bird bills, their red mouths stretched wide around their laughter. Somewhere Glaucus laughed among them, but I could not pick his voice out from the throng. Not all gods need be the same. My face had begun to burn. It was not pain, not exactly, but a stinging that went on and on. I pressed my fingers to my cheeks. How long had it been since I'd thought of Prometheus? A vision of him rose before me now. His torn back and steady face, his dark eyes encompassing everything. Prometheus had not cried out as the blows fell, though he had grown so covered in blood that he'd looked like a statue dipped in gold. And all the while the gods had watched, their attention bright as lightning. They would have relished a turn with the Fury's whip, given the chance. I was not like them. Are you not? The voice was my uncle's, resonant and deep. Then you must think, Circe, what would they not do? My father's chair was draped with the skins of pure black lambs. I knelt by their dangling necks. Father, I said, it was I who made Scylla a monster. All around me voices dropped. I cannot say if the very furthest couches looked, if Glaucus looked, but all my uncles did, snapped up from their drowsy conversation. I felt a sharp joy.
For the first time in my life, I wanted their eyes.
I used wicked Pharmaca to make Glaucus a god, and then I changed Scylla. I was jealous of his love for her and wanted to make her ugly. I did it selfishly, in bitter heart, and I would bear the consequence.
Pharmaca, my father said.
Yes,
the yellow flowers that grow from Cronus's spilt blood and turn creatures to their truest selves. I dug up 100 flowers and dropped them in her pool.
I had expected a whip to be brought forth, a fury summoned, a place in chains beside my uncle's on the rock. But my father only filled his cup. 'Tis no matter. Those flowers have no powers in them, not any more. Zeus and I made sure of that. I stared at him.
Father, I did it. With my own hands, I broke their stalks and smeared the sap on Glaucus's lips, and he was changed.
You had a premonition, which is common in my children. His voice was even, firm as a stone wall. It was Glaucus's fate to be changed at that moment. The herbs did nothing.
No, I tried to say, but he did not pause. His voice lifted to cover my...
Think, daughter, if mortals could be made into gods so easily, would not every goddess feed them to her favorite? And would not half the nymphs be changed to monsters? You are not the first jealous girl in these halls.
My uncles were beginning to smile.
I am the only one who knows where those flowers are. Of course you are not, my uncle Proteus said.
You had that knowledge from me. Do you think I would have given it if I thought you could do any harm?
And if there was so much power in those plants, Neria said, my fish from Scylla's Cove would be changed.
Yet they are whole and well.
My face was flushing.
No,
I shook off Nereus's seaweed hand.
I changed Scylla, and now I must take the punishment on my head.
Daughter, you begin to make a spectacle. The words cut across the air. If the world contained the power you allege, do you think it would fall to such as you to discover it?
Soft laughter at my back, open amusement on my uncle's faces, but most of all my father's voice speaking those words like trash he dropped. Such as you. Any other day in all my years of life I would have curled upon myself and wept. But that day his scorn was like a spark falling on dry tinder. My mouth opened.
You are wrong.
He had leaned away to note something to my grandfather. Now his gaze swung back to mine. His face began to glow.
What did you say?
I say those plants have power.
His skin flared white, white as the fire's heart, as purest, hottest coals. He stood, yet he kept on rising as if he would tear a hole in the ceiling, in the earth's crust, as if he would not cease until he scraped the stars. And then the heat came, rolling over me with a sound like roaring waves, blistering my skin, crushing the breath from my chest. I gasped, but there was no air. He had taken it all.
You dare to contradict me? You who cannot light a single flame or cool one drop of water, worst of my children, faded and broken, whom I cannot pay a husband to take. Since you were born, I pitied you and allowed you license, yet you grew disobedient and proud. Will you make me hate you more?
In another moment, the rocks themselves would have melted, and all my watery cousins dried up to their bones. My flesh bubbled and opened like a roasted fruit. My voice shriveled in my throat and was scorched to dust. The pain was such as I had never imagined could exist, a searing agony consuming every thought. I fell to my father's feet.
Father, I croaked, forgive me. I was wrong to believe such a thing.
Slowly the heat receded. I lay where I had fallen upon the mosaic floor with its fish and purpled fruits. My eyes were half blind. My hands were melted claws. The river gods shook their heads, making sounds like water over rocks.
Helios, you have the strangest children.
My father sighed. It is Perse's fault. All the ones before hers were fine. I did not move. The hours passed and no one looked at me or spoke my name. They talked of their own affairs, of the fineness of the wine and food. The torches went out and the couches emptied. My father rose and stepped over me. The faint breeze he stirred cut into my skin like a knife. I had thought my grandmother might speak a soft word, bring salve to soothe my burns, but she had gone to her bed. Perhaps they will send guards for me, I thought. But why should they,
I was no danger in the world.
The waves of pain ran cold and then hot and then cold again. I shook and the hours passed. My limbs were raw and blackened. My back bubbled over with sores. I was afraid to touch my face. Dawn would come soon, and my whole family would pour in for their breakfasts, chattering of the day's amusement. They would curl their lips as they passed by where I lay. Inch by slow inch, I drew myself to my feet. The thought of returning to my father's halls was like a white coal in my throat. I could not go home. There was only one other place in all the world I knew. Those woods I had dreamed of so often. The deep shadows would hide me and the mossy ground would be soft against my ruined skin. I set that image in my eye and limped towards it. The salt air of the beach stabbed like needles in my blasted throat, and each touch of the wind set my burns screaming again. At last, I felt the shade close over me and I curled up on the moss. It had rained a little and the damp earth was sweet against me. So many times I had imagined lying there with Glaucus. But whatever tears might have been in me for that lost dream had been parched away. I closed my eyes, drifting through the shocks and skulls of pain. Slowly, my relentless divinity began to make headway. My breath eased, my eyes cleared. My arms and legs still ached, but when I brushed them with my fingers, I touched skin instead of char. The sun set, glowing behind the trees. Night came with its stars. It was moondark when my Aunt Selene goes to her dreaming husband. It was that, I think, which gave me heart enough to rise, for I could not have endured the thought of her reporting it. That fool actually went to look at them as if she still believed they worked. The night air tingled across my skin. The grass was dry, flattened by high summer heat. I found the hill and halted up its slope. In the starlight, the flowers looked small, lead grey and faint. I plucked a stalk and held it in my hand. It lay there limp, all its sap dried and gone. What had I thought would happen? That it would leap up and shout, "Your father is wrong. You change Scylla and Glaucus. You are not poor and patchy, but Zeus come again." Yet, as I knelt there, I did hear something. Not a sound, but a sort of silence. A faint hum like the space between note and note in a song. I waited for it to fade into the air, for my mind to right itself. But it went on. I had a wild thought there beneath that sky. I will eat these herbs. Then whatever is truly in me, let it be out at last. I brought them to my mouth. But my courage failed. What was I truly? In the end, I could not bear to know. It was nearly dawn when my uncle Archelaus found me, beard foaming in his haste. "Your brother is here, you are summoned." I followed him to my father's halls, still stumbling a little. Past the polished tables we went, past the draped bedroom where my mother slept. Aetes was standing over our father's draughts board. His face had grown sharp with manhood. His tawny beard was thick as bracken. He was dressed opulently, even for a god, robed in indigos and purples, every inch heavy with embroidered gold. But when he turned to me, I felt the shock of that old love between us. It was only my father's presence that kept me from hurtling into his arms. "Brother," I said, "I've missed you." He frowned. "What is wrong with your face?" I touched my hand to it, and the peeling skin flared with pain. I flushed. I did not want to tell him, not here. My father sat in his burning chair, and even his faint, habitual light made me ache anew. My father spared me from having to answer. "Well, she is come. Speak." I quivered at the sound of his displeasure, but Aeetes' face was calm. As if my father's anger were only another thing in the room, a table, a stool. "I have come," he said, "because I heard of Scylla's transformation, and Glaucus's too. At Circe's hands." "At the Fates' hands. I tell you, Circe has no such power." "You are mistaken." I stared, expecting my father's wrath to fall upon him, But my brother continued.
In my kingdom of Colchis, I have done such things and more, much more. Called milk out of the earth, bewitched men's senses, shaped warriors from dust. I have summoned dragons to draw my chariot. I have said charms that veil the sky with black and brewed potions that raise the dead.
From anyone else's mouth, these claims would have seemed like wild lies. But my brother's voice carried its old, utter conviction.
Pharmakeia, such arts are called, for they deal in pharmaca, those herbs with the power to work changes upon the world, both those sprung from the blood of gods, as well as those which grow common upon the earth. It is a gift to be able to draw out their powers, and I am not alone in possessing it. In Crete, Pasiphae rules with her poisons, and in Babylon, Perses conjures souls into flesh again. Circe is the last and makes the proof. My father's gaze was far away, as if he were looking through sea and earth all the way to Colchis. It might have been some trick of the hearth fire, but I thought the light of his face flickered. Shall I give you a demonstration? My brother drew out from his robes a small pot with a wax seal. He broke the seal and touched his finger to the liquid inside. I smelt something sharp and green with a brackish edge. He pressed his thumb to my face and spoke a word too low for me to hear. My skin began to itch, and then, like a taper snuffed out, the pain was gone. When I put my hand to my cheek, I felt only smoothness, and a faint sheen as if from oil. A good trick, is it not? Aeti said. My father did not answer. He sat strangely dumb. I felt struck dumb myself. The power of healing another's flesh belonged only to the greatest gods, not to such as us. My brother smiled, as if he could hear my thoughts. And that is the least of my powers. They are drawn from the earth itself, and so are not bound by the normal laws of divinity. He let the words hang a moment in the air. I understand, of course, that you can make no judgment now. You must take counsel, but you should know that I would be happy to give Zeus a more impressive demonstration. A look flashed in his eyes, like teeth in a wolf's mouth. My father's words came slowly. That same numbness still masked his face. I understood with an odd jolt. He is afraid. I must take counsel, as you say. This is new. Until it is decided, you will remain in these halls, both of you. I expected no less, Aeti said. He inclined his head and turned to go. I followed. Skin prickling with the rush of my thoughts and a breathless, rearing hope. The myrrh-wood doors shut behind us, and we stood in the hall. Aeti's face was calm, as if he had not just performed a miracle and silenced our father. I had 1,000 questions ready to tumble out, but he spoke first. What have you been doing all this while? You took forever. I was beginning to think maybe you weren't a pharmacist after all. It was not a word I knew. It was not a word anyone knew, then. Pharmakis, I said. Witch. News ran like spring rivers. At dinner, the children of Oceanus whispered when they saw me and skittered out of my path. If our arms brushed, they paled, and when I passed a goblet to a river god, his eyes dodged away. Oh, no, thank you, I'm not thirsty. Aetes laughed. You will get used to it. We are ourselves alone now. He did not seem alone. Every night he sat on my grandfather's dais with my father and our uncles. I watched him drinking nectar, laughing, showing his teeth. His expressions darted like schools of fish in the water, now light, now dark. I waited till our father was gone, then went to sit on a chair near him. I longed to take the place beside him on the couch, lean against his shoulder, but he seemed so grim and straight. I did not know how to touch him. You like your kingdom, Colchis? It is the finest in the world, he said. I have done what I said, sister. I have gathered there all the wonders of our lands. I smiled to hear him call me sister, to speak of those old dreams. I wish I could see it. He said nothing. He was a magician who could break the teeth of snakes, tear up oaks by their roots,
He did not need me. Do you have Daedalus too? He made a face.
No. Pasiphae has him trapped.
Perhaps in time. I have a giant fleece made of gold, though, and half a dozen dragons. I did not have to draw his stories out of him. They burst forth. The spells and charms he cast, the beasts he summoned, the herbs he cut by moonlight and brewed into miracles. Each tale was more outlandish than the last. Thunder leaping to his fingertips, lambs cooked and born again from their charred bones.
What was it you spoke when you healed my skin?
A word of power. Will you teach it to me?
Sorcery cannot be taught. You find it yourself, or you do not.
I thought of the humming I had heard when I touched those flowers, the eerie knowledge that had glided through me.
How long have you known you could do such things?
Since I was born, he said.
But I had to wait until I was out from father's eye.
All those years beside me, and he had said nothing. I opened my mouth to demand, how could you not tell me? But this new Aeetes in his vivid robes was too unnerving.
Were you not afraid, I said, that father would be angry?
No. I was not fool enough to try to humiliate him in front of everyone.
He lifted his eyebrows at me and I flushed.
Anyway, he is eager to imagine how such strength may be used to his benefit. His worry is over Zeus.
He must paint us just right, that we are threat enough that Zeus should think twice, but not so much that he is forced to act.
My brother, who had always seen into the cracks of the world.
What if the Olympians try to take your spells from you?
He smiled.
I think they cannot, whatever they try.
As I said, Pharmakeia is not bound by the usual limits of gods.
I looked down at my hands and tried to imagine them weaving a spell to shake the world. But the certainty I had felt when I dripped the sap into Glaucus's mouth and tainted Scylla's cove, I could not seem to find any more. Perhaps, I thought, if I could touch those flowers again. But I was not allowed to leave until my father spoke to Zeus.
And you think I can work such wonders as you do?
No, my brother said. I am the strongest of the four of us. But you do show a taste for transformation.
That was only the flowers, I said.
They grant creatures their truest forms.
He turned his philosopher's eye on me. You do not think it convenient that their truest forms should happen to be your desires?
I stared at him.
I did not desire to make Scylla a monster. I only meant to reveal the ugliness within her.
And you believe that's what was truly in her, a six-headed, slavering horror?
My face was stinging.
Why not? You did not know her. She was very cruel. He laughed.
Oh, Circe. She was a painted backhall slattern, same as the rest.
If you will argue one of the greatest monsters of our age was hiding within her, then you are more of a fool than I thought.
I do not think anyone can say what is in someone else.
He rolled his eyes and poured himself another cup.
What I think, he said, is that Scylla has escaped the punishment you intended for her.
What do you mean?
Think. What would an ugly nymph do in our halls? What is the worth of her life?
It was like the old days, him asking and me without answers.
I don't know.
Of course you do.
It's why it would have been a good punishment.
Even the most beautiful nymph is largely useless, and an ugly one would be nothing, less than nothing. She would never marry or produce children. She would be a burden to her family, a stain upon the face of the world. She would live in the shadows, scorned and reviled.
But a monster, he said.
She always has a place. She may have all the glory her teeth can snatch. She will not be loved for it. But she will not be constrained either. So whatever foolish sorrow you harbor, forget it. I think it may be said that you improved her.
For 2 nights, my father was closeted with my uncles. I lingered outside the mahogany doors but could hear nothing, not even a murmur. When they emerged, their faces were set and grim. My father strode to his chariot. His purple cloak glowed dark as wine, and on his head shone his great crown of golden rays. He did not look back as he leapt into the sky and turned the horses towards Olympus. We waited in Oceanus's halls for his return. No one lounged on the riverbank or twined with a lover in the shadows. The naiads squabbled with red cheeks. The river gods shoved each other. From his dais, my grandfather stared out over all of us, his cup empty in his hand. My mother was boasting among her sisters. Perses and Pasiphae were the ones who knew first, of course. Is it any wonder Circe was last? I plan to have 100 more, and they will make me a silver boat that flies through the clouds. We will rule upon Olympus. Perse, my grandmother hissed across the room. Only Aeetes did not seem to feel the tension. He sat serene on his couch, drinking from his wrought gold cup. I kept to the back, pacing the long passageways, running my hands over the rock walls, always faintly damp from the presence of so many water gods. I scanned the room to see if Glaucus had come. There was still a piece of me that longed to look upon him even then. When I asked Aeetes if Glaucus feasted with the rest of the gods, he had grinned. He's hiding that blue face of his. He's waiting for everyone to forget the truth of how he came by it. My stomach twisted. I had not thought how my confession would take Glaucus's greatest pride from him. Too late, I thought. Too late for all the things I should have known. I had made so many mistakes that I could not find my way back through their tangle to the first one. Was it changing Scylla, changing Glaucus, swearing the oath to my grandmother, speaking to Glaucus in the first place? I felt a sickening unease that it went back further still, back to the first breath I ever drew. My father would be standing before Zeus now. My brother was sure that the Olympians could do nothing to us. But four Titan witches could not be easily dismissed. What if war came again? The great hall would crack open over us. Zeus's head would blot out the light and his hand would reach down to crush us one by one. Aeetes would call his dragons. At least he could fight. But what could I do? Pick flowers? My mother was bathing her feet. Two sisters held the silver basin, a third poured the sweet myrrh oil from its flask. I was being a fool, I told myself. There would be no war. My father was an old hand at such maneuvering. He would find a way to appease Zeus. The room brightened and my father came. On his face was a look like hammered bronze. Our eyes followed him as he strode to the dais at the room's front. The rays from his crown speared every shadow. He stared out over us. I have spoken to Zeus, he said. We have found our way to an agreement. A suffering relief from my cousins like wind through wheat. He agrees that something new moves in the world, that these powers are unlike any that have come before. He agrees that they grow from my four children with the nymph Perse. A ripple again, this one tinged with growing excitement. My mother licked her lips, tilting her chin as if there were already a crown on her head. Her sisters glanced at each other, gnawing on their envy. We have agreed as well that these powers present no immediate danger. Perses lives beyond our boundaries and is no threat. Pasiphaeus's husband is the son of Zeus, and he will be sure she is held to her proper place. Aeetes will keep his kingdom so long as he agrees to be watched. My brother nodded gravely, but I saw the smile in his eyes. I can veil the sky itself. Just try to watch me. Each of them has sworn besides that their powers came unbidden and unlooked for from no malice or attempted revolt. They stumbled upon the magic of herbs by accident. Surprised, I darted another glance at my brother, but his face was unreadable. Each of them, except for Circe. You were all here when she confessed that she sought her powers openly. She had been warned to stay away, yet she disobeyed. My grandmother's face, cold in her ivory-carved chair. She defied my commands and contradicted my authority. She has turned her poisons against her own kind and committed other treacheries as well. The white sear of his gaze landed on me. She is a disgrace to our name, an ingrate to the care we have shown her. It is agreed with Zeus that for this she must be punished. She is exiled to a deserted island where she can do no more harm. She leaves tomorrow. 1,000 eyes pinned me. I wanted to cry out, to plead, but my breath would not catch. My voice, ever thin, was gone.
Aetes will speak for me, I thought, but when I cast my gaze to him, he only looked back with all the rest.
One more thing, my father said. As I noted, it is clear that the source of this new power comes from my union with Perse.
My mother's face, glossy with triumph, beaming through my haze.
So it is agreed, I will sire no more children upon her.
My mother screamed, falling backwards on her sister's laps. Her sobs echoed off the stone walls. My grandfather got slowly to his feet. He rubbed at his chin.
Well, he said, it is time for the feast.
The torches burned like stars, and overhead the ceiling stretched high as the sky's vault. For the last time, I watched all the gods and nymphs take their places. I felt dazed. I should say goodbye, I kept thinking. But my cousins flowed away from me like water around a rock. I heard their sneering whispers as they passed. I found myself missing Scylla. At least she would have dared to speak to my face. My grandmother, I thought, I must try to explain. But she turned away as well, and her sea snake buried its head. All the while my mother wept in her flock of sisters. When I came close, she raised her face so everyone could see her beautiful, extravagant grief. Have you not done enough? That left only my uncles, with their kelp hair and briny, scraggled beards. Yet when I thought of kneeling at their feet, I could not bring myself to do it. I went back to my room. Pack, I told myself. Pack, you are leaving tomorrow. But my hands hung numbly at my sides. How should I know what to bring? I had scarcely ever left these halls. I forced myself to find a bag to gather clothes and sandals, a brush for my hair. I considered a tapestry on my wall. It was of a wedding and its party, woven by some aunt. Would I even have a house to hang it in? I did not know. I did not know anything. A deserted island, my father had said. Would it be bare rock exposed upon the sea, a pebbled shoal, a tangled wilderness? My bag was an absurdity, filled of gilded detritus. The knife, I thought, the lion's head knife, I will bring that. But when I held it, it looked shrunken, meant to spear up morsels at a feast and no more. It could have been much worse, you know. Aetes had come to stand in my doorway. He was leaving too, his dragons already summoned. I heard Zeus wanted to make an example of you, but of course father can only allow him so much license. The hairs stirred on my arms. You did not tell him about Prometheus, did you? He smiled.
Why, because he spoke of other treacheries. You know, father, he's only been cautious in case some further terror of yours comes to light. Anyway, what is there to tell? What did you do, after all? Pour a single glass of nectar?
I looked up. You said father would have thrown me to the crows for it.
Only if you were fool enough to admit it.
My face was hot. I suppose I should take you as my tutor and deny everything.
Yes, he said. That is how it works, Circe. I tell father that my sorcery was an accident, he pretends to believe me, and Zeus pretends to believe him, and so the world is balanced. It is your own fault for confessing. Why you did that, I will never understand.
It was true. He would not. He had not been born when Prometheus was whipped.
I meant to tell you, he said. I finally met your Glaucus last night. I have never seen such a buffoon.
He clicked his tongue.
I hope you will choose better ahead.
You have always trusted too easily. I looked at him leaning in my doorway with his long robes and bright wolfish eyes. My heart had leapt to see him as it always did. He was like that column of water he had told me of once, cold and straight, sufficient to himself. Thank you for your counsel, I said.
He left and I considered the tapestry again. Its groom was goggle-eyed, the bride buried in her veils, and behind them the family gaped like idiots. I had always hated it. Let it stay and rot.
Chapter 7. The next morning I stepped into my father's chariot and we lurched into the dark sky without a word. The air blew past us. Night receded at every turning of the wheels. I looked over the side, trying to track the rivers and seas, the shadowed valleys, but we were going too fast and I recognized nothing.
What island is it?
My father did not answer. His jaw was set. His lips bled pale with anger. My old burns were aching from standing so close to him. I closed my eyes. The land streamed by and the wind ran across my skin. I imagined pitching over that golden rail into the open air below. It would feel good, I thought, before I hid. We landed with a jolt. I opened my eyes to see a high, soft hill, thick with grass. My father stared straight ahead. I felt a sudden urge to fall on my knees and beg him to take me back. But instead, I forced myself to step down onto the ground. The moment my foot touched, he and his chariot were gone. I stood alone in that grassy clearing. The breeze blew sharp against my cheeks and the air had a fresh scent. I could not savor it. My head felt heavy and my throat had begun to ache. I swayed. By now, Aetes was back on Colchis, drinking his milk and honey. My aunts would be laughing on their riverbanks. My cousins returned to their games. My father, of course, was overhead, shedding his light down on the world. All those years I had spent with them were like a stone tossed in a pool. Already the ripples were gone. I had a little pride. If they did not weep, I would not either. I pressed my palms to my eyes until they cleared. I made myself look around. On the hilltop before me was a house, wide-porched. Its walls built from finely fitted stone, its doors carved twice the height of a man. A little below stretched a hem of forests, and beyond that a glimpse of the sea. It was the forest that drew my eye. It was old growth, gnarled with oaks and lindens and olive groves, shot through with spearing cypress. That's where the green scent came from, drifting up the grassy hillside. The trees shook themselves thickly in the sea winds and birds darted through the shadows. Even now, I can remember the wonder I felt. All my life had been spent in the same dim halls or walking the same stunted shore with its threadbare woods. I was not prepared for such profusion, and I felt the sudden urge to throw myself in like a frog into a pond. I hesitated. I was no wood nymph. I did not have the knack of feeling my way over roots or walking through brambles untouched. I could not guess what those shadows might conceal. What if there were sinkholes within? What if there were bears or lions? I stood there a long time, fearing such things and waiting as if someone would come and reassure me, say, yes, you may go, it will be safe. My father's chariot slipped over the sea and began to douse itself in the waves. The shadows of the forest deepened and the trunks seemed to twine against each other. It is too late to go now, I told myself. Tomorrow. The doors of the house were broad oak, banded with iron. They swung easily at my touch. Inside, the air smelt of incense. There was a great room set with tables and benches as if for a feast. A hearth anchored one end. At the other, a corridor led away to the kitchen and bedrooms. It was large enough to hold a dozen goddesses, and indeed, I kept expecting to find nymphs and cousins around every turn. But no, that was part of my exile. To be utterly alone. What worse punishment could there be, my family thought, than to be deprived of their divine presence? Certainly the house itself was no punishment. Treasures shone on every side, carved chests, soft rugs and golden hangings, beds, stools, intricate tripods and ivory statues. The windowsills were white marble, the shutters scrolled ashwood. In the kitchen I ran my thumb across the knives, bronze and iron, but also nacre shell and obsidian. I found bowls of quartz crystal and wrought silver. Though the rooms were deserted, there was no speck of dust, and I would learn that none could cross the marble threshold. However I tracked upon it, the floor was always clean, the tables gleaming. The ashes vanished from the fireplace, the dishes washed themselves, and the firewood regrew overnight. In the pantry there were jars of oil and wine, bowls of cheese and barley grain, always fresh and full.
among those empty, perfect rooms, I felt, I could not say, disappointed.
There was a part of me, I think, that had hoped for a crag in the Caucasus after all, and an eagle diving for my liver. But Scylla was no Zeus, and I was no Prometheus. We were nymphs, not worth the trouble.
There was more to it than that, though. My father might have left me in a hovel or a fisherman's shack, on a bare beach with nothing but a tent.
I thought back to his face when he spoke of Zeus's decree, his clear, ringing rage.
I had assumed it was all for me, but now, after my talks with Aeetes, I began to understand more.
The truce between the gods held only because Titans and Olympians each kept to their sphere. Zeus had demanded the discipline of Helios's blood. Helios could not speak back openly, but he could make an answer of sorts, a message of defiance to rebalance the scales. Even our exiles live better than kings. You see how deep our strength runs. If you strike us, Olympian, we rise higher than before. That was my new home, a monument to my father's pride. It was past sundown by then. I found the flint and struck it over the waiting tinder, as I had seen Glaucus do so often, but never attempted myself. It took me several tries, and when the flames began to catch and spread at last, I felt a novel satisfaction. I was hungry, so I went to the pantry, where the bowls brimmed with enough food to feed 100. I spooned some onto a plate and sat at one of the great oak tables in the hall. I could hear the sound of my breath. It struck me that I had never eaten by myself. Even when no one spoke to me or looked at me, there was always some cousin or sibling at my elbow. I rubbed the fine-grained wood. I hummed a little and listened to the sound being swallowed by the air. This is what it will be all my days, I thought. Despite the fire, shadows were gathering in the corners. Outside, birds had begun to scream. At least I thought they were birds. I felt the hairs stir on my neck. Thinking again of those dark, thick trunks, I went to the shutters and closed them. I latched the door. I was used to the weight of all the earth's rocks surrounding me and my father's power on top of that. The house's walls felt to me leaf-thin. Any claw would tear them open. Perhaps that is the secret of this place, I thought. My true punishment is yet to come. Stop, I told myself. I lit tapers and made myself carry them down the hall to my room. In the daylight it had seemed large, and I had been pleased, but now I could not watch every corner at once. The feathers of the bed murmured against each other, and the shutter wood creaked like the ropes of ships in a storm. All around me I felt the wild hollows of the island swelling in their dark. Until that moment, I had not known how many things I feared. Huge, ghostly leviathans slithering up the hillside, nightworms squirming out of their burrows, pressing their blind faces to my door. Goat-footed gods eager to feed their savage appetites, pirates muffling their oars in my harbor, planning how they would take me. And what could I do? Pharmacus, Aeetes named me, witch. But all my strength was in those flowers oceans away. If anyone came, I would only be able to scream, and 1,000 nymphs before me knew what good that did. The fear sloshed over me, each wave colder than the last. The still air crawled across my skin, and shadows reached out their hands. I stared into the darkness, straining to hear past the beat of my own blood. Each moment felt the length of a night, but at last the sky took on a deepening texture and began to pale at its edge. The shadows ebbed away, and it was morning. I stood up, whole and untouched. When I went outside, there were no prowling footprints, no slithering tail marks, no gouges clawed in the door. Yet I did not feel foolish. I felt as if I had passed a great ordeal. I looked again into that forest. Yesterday, was it only yesterday? I had waited for someone to come and tell me it was safe. But who would that be? My father? Aeetes? That is what exile meant. No one was coming, no one ever would. There was fear in that knowledge. But after my long night of terrors, it felt small and inconsequential. The worst of my cowardice had been sweated out. In its place was a giddy spark.
I will not be like a bird bred in a cage, I thought, too dull to fly even when the door stands open. I stepped into those woods, and my life began. I learned to braid my hair back so it would not catch on every twig, and how to tie my skirts at the knee to keep the burrs off. I learned to recognize the different blooming vines and gaudy roses, to spot the shining dragonflies and coiling snakes. I climbed the peaks where the cypresses speared black into the sky, then clambered down to the orchards and vineyards where purple grapes grew thick as coral. I walked the hills, the buzzing meadows of thyme and lilac, and set my footprints across the yellow beaches. I searched out every cove and grotto, found the gentle bays, the harbor safe for ships. I heard the wolves howl and the frogs cry from their mud. I stroked the glossy brown scorpions who braved me with their tails. Their poison was barely a pinch. I was drunk, as the wine and nectar in my father's halls had never made me. No wonder I have been so slow, I thought. All this while I have been a weaver without wool, a ship without the sea. Yet now look where I sail. At night I went home to my house. I did not mind its shadows anymore, for they meant my father's gaze was gone from the sky, and the hours were my own. I did not mind the emptiness either. For 1,000 years I had tried to fill the space between myself and my family. Filling the rooms of my house was easy by comparison. I burned cedar in the fireplace, and its dark smoke kept me company. I sang, which had never been allowed before, since my mother said I had the voice of a drowning gull. And when I did get lonely, when I found myself yearning for my brother, or Glaucus as he had been, then there was always the forest. The lizards darted along the branches, the birds flashed their wings. The flowers, when they saw me, seemed to press forward like eager puppies, leaping and clamoring for my touch. I felt almost shy of them, but day by day I grew bolder, and at last I knelt in the damp earth before a clump of hellebore. The delicate blooms fluttered on their stalks. I did not need a knife to cut them, only the edge of my nail, which grew sticky with flecks of sap. I put the flowers in a basket covered with cloth, and only uncovered them when I was home again, my shutters firmly closed. I did not think anyone would try to stop me, but I did not intend to tempt them to it. I looked at the blossoms lying on my table. They seemed shrunken, etiolated. I did not have the first idea what I should do to them. Chop? Boil? Roast? There had been oil in my brother's ointment, but I did not know what kind. Would olive from the kitchen work? Surely not. It must be something fantastical, like seed oil pressed from the fruits of the Hesperides. But I could not get that. I rolled a stalk beneath my finger. It turned over, limp as a drowned worm. Well, I said to myself, do not just stand there like a stone. Try something. Boil them. Why not? I had a little pride, as I have said, and that was good. More would have been fatal. Let me say what sorcery is not. It is not divine power, which comes with a thought and a blink. It must be made and worked, planned and searched out. Dug up, dried, chopped and ground, cooked, spoken over and sung. Even after all that, it can fail, as gods do not. If my herbs are not fresh enough, if my attention falters, if my will is weak, the drafts go stale and rancid in my hands. By rights, I should never have come to witchcraft. Gods hate all toil, 'tis their nature. The closest we come is weaving or smithing, but these things are skills, and there is no drudgery to them, since all the parts that might be unpleasant are taken away with power. The wool is dyed not with stinking vats and stirring spoons, but with a snap. There is no tedious mining. The oars leap willingly from the mountain. No fingers are ever chafed, no muscles strained. Witchcraft is nothing but such drudgery. Each herb must be found in its den, harvested at its time, grubbed up from the dirt, culled and stripped, washed and prepared. It must be handled this way, then that, to find out where its power lies. Day upon patient day. You must throw out your errors and begin again. So why did I not mind? Why did none of us mind? I cannot speak for my brothers and sister, but my answer is easy. For 100 generations, I had walked the world drowsy and dull, idle and at my ease. I left no prints, I did no deeds. Even those who had loved me a little did not care to stay. Then I learned that I could bend the world to my will, as a bow is bent for an arrow. I would have done that toil 1,000 times to keep such power in my hands. I thought, this is how Zeus felt when he first lifted the thunderbolt. At first, of course, all I brewed were mistakes. Drafts that did nothing, pastes that crumbled and lay dead on the table. I thought that if some roux was good, more was better. That 10 herbs mixed were superior to 5, that I could let my mind wander and the spell would not wander with it, that I could begin making one draft and halfway through decide to make another. I did not know even the simplest herb lore that any mortal would learn at her mother's knee, that wort plants boiled make a sort of soap, that yew burnt in the hearth sends up a choking smog, that poppies had sleep in their veins and hellebore death, and yarrow could close over wounds. All these things had to be worked and learned through errors and trials, burnt fingers and fetid clouds that sent me running outside to cough in the garden. At least, I thought, in those early days, once I cast a spell, I would not have to learn it again. But even that was not true. However often I had used a herb before, each cutting had its own character. One rose would give up its secrets if it were ground, another must be pressed, a third steeped. Each spell was a mountain to be climbed anew. All I could carry with me from the last time was the knowledge that it could be done. I pressed on. If my childhood had given me anything, it was endurance. Little by little, I began to listen better, to the sap moving in the plants, to the blood in my veins. I learned to understand my own intention, to prune and to add, to feel where the power gathered and speak the right words to draw it to its height. That was the moment I lived for, when it all came clear at last and the spell could sing with its pure note for me and me alone. I did not call dragons or summon serpents. My earliest charms were silly things, whatever came into my head. I started with an acorn, for I had some thought that if the object were green growing, nourished by water, my naiad blood might give me some help. For days, months, I rubbed that acorn with oils and salves, speaking words over it to make it sprout. I tried to mimic the sounds I had heard Aetes make when he had healed my face. I tried curses and prayers, too. But through it all, the acorn kept its seed smugly within. I threw it out the window and got a new one, and crouched over that for another 30 years. I tried the spell when I was angry, when I was calm, when I was happy, when I was half-distracted. One day I told myself that I would rather have no powers than try that spell again. What did I want with an oak seedling anyway? The island was full of them. What I really wanted was a wild strawberry to slip sweetly down my irritable throat, and so I told that brown hull. It changed so fast my thumb sank into its soft red body. I stared, and then I whooped with triumph, startling the birds outside from their trees. I brought a withered flower back to life. Banished flies from my house. I made the cherries blossom out of season and turned the fire vivid green. If Aetes had been there, he would have choked on his beard to see such kitchen tricks. Yet because I knew nothing, nothing was beneath me. My powers lapped upon themselves like waves. I found I had a knack for illusion, summoning shadow crumbs for the mice to creep after, making pale minnows leap from the waves beneath the cormorant's beak. I thought larger. A ferret to frighten off the moles, an owl to keep away the rabbits. I learned that the best time to harvest was beneath the moon, when dew and darkness concentrated sap. I learned what grew well in a garden and what must be left to its place in the woods. I caught snakes and learned how to milk their teeth. I could coax a drop of venom from the tail of a wasp. I healed a dying tree. I killed a poisonous vine with a touch. But Aetes had been right. My greatest gift was transformation, and that was always where my thoughts returned. I stood before a rose, and it became an iris. A draft poured onto the roots of an ash tree changed it into a holm oak. I turned all my firewood to cedar so that its scent would fill my halls each night. I caught a bee and made it into a toad. and a scorpion into a mouse. There I discovered at last the limits of my power. However potent the mixture, however well woven the spell, the toad kept trying to fly, and the mouse to sting. Transformation touched only bodies, not minds. I thought of Scylla then. Did her nymph self live still inside that six-headed monster? Or did plants grown from the blood of gods make the change a true one? I did not know. Into the air, I said, wherever you are, I hope you are finding your satisfaction. Which, of course, now I know she was. It was one day during that time that I found myself among the thickest brakes of the forest. I loved to walk the island, from its lowest shores to its highest haunts, seeking out the hidden mosses and ferns and vines, collecting their leaves for my charms. It was late afternoon, and my basket overflowed. I stepped around a bush, and the boar was there. I had known for some time that there were wild pigs on the island. I'd heard them squealing and crashing in the brush, and often I would find some rhododendron trampled or a stand of saplings rooted up. This was the first one I had seen. He was huge, even bigger than I had imagined a boar could be. His spine rose steep and black as the ridges of Mount Kynthos, and his shoulders were slashed with the thunderbolt scars of his fights. Only the bravest heroes face such creatures. And then they are armed with spears and dogs, archers and assistants, and usually half a dozen warriors besides. I had only my digging knife and my basket and not a single spell draught to hand. He stamped, and the white foam dripped from his mouth. He lowered his tusks and ground his jaws. His pig eyes said, I can break 100 youths and send their bodies back to wailing mothers. I will tear your entrails and eat them for my lunch. I fixed my gaze on his. Try, I said. For a long moment, he stared at me. Then he turned and twitched off through the brush. I tell you, for all my spells, that was the first time I truly felt myself a witch. At my hearth that night, I thought of those prancing goddesses who carry birds on their shoulders, or have some fawn always nuzzling their hands, tripping delicately at their heels. I would put them to shame, I thought. I climbed to the highest peaks and found a lonely track. Here a flower crushed. Here the dirt turned a little and some bark clawed off. I brewed a potion with crocus and yellow jasmine, iris and cypress root dug at the moon's full height. I sprinkled it, singing, I summon you. She came rippling through my door at the next dusk, her shoulder muscles hard as stones. She lay across my hearth and rasped my ankles with her tongue. During the day, she brought me rabbits and fish. At night, she licked honey from my fingers and slept upon my feet. Sometimes we would play, she stalking behind me, then leaping up to grapple me by the neck. I smelled the hot musk of her breath, felt the weight of her forepaws pressing on my shoulders. Look, I said, showing her the knife I had carried with me from my father's halls, the one stamped with a lion's face. What fool made this? They have never seen your like. She cracked her great brown mouth in a yawn. There was a bronze mirror in my bedroom, tall as the ceiling. When I passed it, I scarcely knew myself. My gaze seemed brighter, my face sharper. And there behind me paced my wild lion familiar. I could imagine what my cousins would say if they saw me, my feet dirty from working in the garden, my skirts knotted up around my knees, singing at the height of my frail voice. I wished that they would come. I wanted to see those goggle eyes of theirs as I walked among the dens of wolves, swam in the sea where the sharks fed. I could change a fish to a bird. I could wrestle with my lion, then lie across her belly, my hair loose around me. I wanted to hear them squeal and gasp, breath struck. Oh, she looked at me. Now I will be a frog. Had I truly feared such creatures? Had I really spent 10,000 years ducking like a mouse? I understood now Aiti's boldness, how he had stood before our father like a towering peak. When I did my magics, I felt that same span and heft. I tracked my father's burning chariot across the sky. Well, what do you have to say to me? You threw me to the crows, but it turns out I prefer them to you. No answer came, and none from my Aunt Moon either. Those cowards. My skin was glowing, my teeth set. My lioness lashed her tail. Does no one have the courage? Will no one dare to face me? So you see, in my way, I was eager for what came.